good evening. Thank you for coming out for the sixth in our series of six, and that means we have the hardcore at this point, the people who are left standing, or I should say sitting, at the end of the year. Our series of medical halacha shiurim, which are sponsored by the Lipsitz family in memory of Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yitzchak Halevi, and Rabbi Avram, Rabbi Yitzchak. They sponsored the year's series, and I want to thank them in absentia, because most of them couldn't be here for it tonight, but you're the representative, to thank them for sponsoring the series here at Shire Shamayim. Please make sure that you sign in. Please make sure also that you take evaluation forms. Where are the sign-in sheets? Anyone know where the sheets are? They're here. Okay, so if you could just make sure that you sign in, especially for people who want CME credit, but even if you're not looking for CME credit, it's important to sign in so that I can get back to you with information afterwards. Inevitably, there are questions that come up in the course of the talk that require follow-up by email later. So please make sure that you do sign in. Can someone open the other door there? It looks like we need the second door open. I think there's someone who wanted to come in who couldn't make it in through one door.
I don't think she's...
Oh, you don't just come in. Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you. Okay. So, the topic tonight is the obligation to heal and be healed. And what I want to look at are some of the difficult ethical challenges which physicians and medical practitioners in general face in the course of treatment. We know that patient care is a mitzvah. We'll talk about what mitzvah it might be this evening. But there are times when the patient doesn't want to be treated or doesn't want to be treated in the way that the physician would prefer to treat. There are situations in which the patient may want one track and the physician has the opportunity to get the patient to do what the doctor thinks the patient should be doing, but it's going to involve deception. So we have to talk about whether that's ethical and whether that's appropriate. You saw already what the vignettes are. They're on the sheets. And these are complex and challenging questions. As always, practical questions go to the shul rabbi. We're just discussing the issues that can come up. But I want to take a look at the three vignettes with an eye towards framing what we're going to discuss. Please note, when I bring a vignette, I am not a doctor. I am not claiming expertise on these cases. And don't get too hung up on the specifics of which treatment it's talking about and which condition is being described. The point is the ethical question that's at the core. So take a look at the first one, please. Susan, 89, has emphysema, cataracts, and trigeminal neuralgia. So the point out of this set of diseases that she's suffering is that she's someone who's dealing with a painful situation in trigeminal neuralgia. From what I understand, this is number one, extremely painful, and number two, we don't have great treatment options for it. She's dealing with cataracts, which reduce her quality of life in terms of her vision, and she's dealing with emphysema, and I'm imagining a level of emphysema where she can't breathe, she can't get out, she can't travel around, but it's not fatal to her at its current stage. She's diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer. Her doctor says the tumor is treatable with chemotherapy. Is Susan entitled to refuse the treatment? Now again, don't get hung up in stage 2 versus stage 3 versus stage 4. The point is she has a condition now which, left untreated, is going to be fatal. The doctor says, I can take care of this for you now, and she says, I don't want you to. She says, let this be the bullet. I'm tired. I can't put up with the pain I'm dealing with. I'd rather not be treated. Is she entitled? So we're not looking at this from the physician perspective yet. We're looking at it from the patient perspective. Is she entitled to refuse treatment? What would you say offhand? Or based on prior knowledge? You say yes. Yes. Is that yes as a human statement, or is that yes based on something that we know from Judaism? Nothing wrong with either answer. I'm just, yeah.
I'm just thinking about, I don't know if it's any different, because it's a very different circumstance. She
Right. Well, in the case of Rohini ben Travian, which you mentioned, which you're right, does come up in this sort of discussion. For those who aren't familiar with his story, he's actually dying. He's being murdered by the Romans. They wrap him up in a Torah scroll for the as a penalty for having taught Torah. This is a story going back about 1800 years. And they set him on fire, and they have sponges inside between the scroll and his body so that he should die slower. And the his students say that he should open his mouth so that he will die sooner and that the fires consume him from within. And he refuses. He says, let God take my life. I'm not going to do anything to accelerate that that death. But then on the other hand, the executioner asks, and I assume this is what you're referring to, the executioner asks, if I remove the sponges, will I merit life in the next world? And his answer is yes. And so the executioner removes the sponges and then jumps into the fire. But the point is, he approves removal of the sponges, which is going to hasten his death. Can we draw an analogy between that and this woman saying, I don't want to be treated for the breast cancer? Right, that was your point. It's certainly a possibility. Yes, Ellen. Right, because he refuses to open his mouth in order to cause himself to die sooner. He doesn't want to actively do it. He's willing to allow somebody else to do it. So here, in effect, is a lot like allowing, in the sense that she's not doing anything to hasten her death. She's not going out and exposing herself to anything that could accelerate the growth of the cancer. She's simply saying, I don't want to be treated. Yes? Right, so here's another argument. It's the old withholding treatment versus withdrawing treatment argument. It's not as though something is being administered and she's putting a halt to it and removing it. She's simply saying, I don't want to begin the treatment. Good point. Yes?
I
The chemotherapy itself may increase her suffering. Certainly a possibility as well, something that she would be able to consider in this. Zeb? Right, so Zev points out that Maimonides does write that one is obligated to maintain his health in order to be able to serve God. Now, the woman in question in this vignette may respond, I can't serve God in my state. Try serving God with trigeminal neuralgia. It's a very, it's an exceedingly painful condition. Add in the cataracts, add in the emphysema, and she says, what am I doing serving God anyway in this position? But you're right, we do have such an imperative. So let's look at this vignette in light of the sources and see what we can do with it. The, really what we have to do first is answer the question of what obligates the patient to seek healing in the first place. Because there is an inherent problem in seeking healing at human hands. If you take a look at source number one, a verse out of Deuteronomy, God declares, and this is one of several verses along the same lines biblically, I could have taken any one of them, Re'u ataki ani anihu. God says, I am He. Ve'ein Elokim imadi. There is no other power with me. Ani amis v'achayeh. He says, I will kill and I will bring to life. That's one of the verses that's quoted as a source for the Jewish belief in an ultimate resurrection of the dead. That the righteous will come back to earth because look at the order. I will kill and I will bring to life. Suggests that there is life afterwards. But that's not the point for this. The point is the next line. Machatzti, I strike, v'ani erpa, and I heal. God says, I am the healer. Well, once God declares that I heal, maybe there's something wrong with a human being taking that role. Maybe this is the divine preserve, and it's not for a human being to do. On the other hand, we know that the Talmud says it's not so. Based on biblical text. The Torah describes a situation in which person A harms person B. There's a fight, he slugs him, whatever it is. The rule is that if you harm somebody else, you're responsible to pay five different types of damages. One of them is called nezek, and that's the depreciation of the person, what that person would be worth, so to speak, on the open market. How that's calculated is very entertaining and not for the moment. The tsar is pain. Riboy is medical bills. I'm going to come back to that. Sheves, time lost from work. And boshes, humiliation. Those are the different ways in which somebody must pay for harming somebody else. So one of them is Ripoy. He has to pay medical bills. It's a biblical text. It says, Virapo yirape, he shall surely heal. He has a responsibility to heal the person. Well, take a look at source number two. Bei Rabbi Yishmael Omer, they said in the yeshiva of Rabbi Yishmael, the Torah says, Virapo yirape, he shall heal. Mikan shenitan rishus lerope, lerapos. From here we see, permission is given to the doctor to heal. How could God say, he shall heal, that he has a responsibility to pay somebody to heal the victim, unless we believe in healing the victim? It must be that there's such a thing as medical practice. So on the one hand, God says, I am the healer. On the other hand, we say no, that there actually is permission to heal, and that permission actually becomes obligation. Take a look at source number three, please. A line also from the Talmud. Minayin laroa es chaveroshu toveya banahar, ochaya gorarto, olistin vayin olav, shuchaya vlahatsilo. How do I know that if you see somebody else who is drowning in a river, who's being dragged by a wild animal, or is being attacked by bandits, how do I know, shuchayev lahatzilo, that you are obligated to save him? Talmud lomar, because the Torah says, lo sa'amod al dam reyacha, don't stand by the blood of your neighbor. If somebody is suffering, I am responsible to intervene. Notice the three different types of suffering that were mentioned here. These are chosen specifically by the Talmud. What's the difference between the three examples that you see here in source number three? What do you see here to distinguish between each of the three cases? What do you see here? Accident from God and man? Sorry, I would say something very similar. Sorry? You have something? I think what you see here is, the first case, he's drowning in a river. There is no volition involved at all. There is no one with any intent, any mind attacking him. He's a victim of a river. In the second case, there is an animal. There is will. It's the animal will. And then the third case, he's being attacked by a person. And in all three cases, on every level, I am obligated to intervene. The first one, the river, is the one that most closely resembles what we term today act of God. The idea that some damage, some danger is besetting a person, not because of any decision made, but the river flooded and it carried him away. And yet we are told, intervene. It's your obligation to stand up and get involved. So that leads me to a question. Does that mean I'm supposed to countermand God's order, so to speak? God made the person sick, and I'm now going to heal him? The question was put by a Roman leader by the name of Turnus Rufus to Rabbi Akiva. He says to Rabbi Akiva in the 2nd century, he says, you are acting against God because you give tzedakah. You are philanthropic. God made the person indigent. By what right do you give the person money? If God wanted the person to have money, he would provide money for the person. To which, you know, our answer is that the purpose of this whole system is that we are supposed to learn to help each other, whether that's financially or emotionally, socially, whatever. There are all ways in which each individual is able to help somebody else. We believe that we are supposed to act that way. The same argument is presented regarding healing. Take a look, please, at source number four. And a comment from Ramban, Nachmanides, writing in the 13th century. He says, Ve'haklal, the rule is, Ki b'hiyos Yisrael shleimim v'heim rabim. He says, when the Jews are complete, when we are in a complete state, and what he means by that is spiritually complete, Lo yisnaheg in yonam b'teva klal. The laws of nature will not control them, will not govern them. They will be above the laws of nature, can't be hurt. Ad shelo yitzdarchu l'rofe ulishtamer b'derech midarkei refuos klal. They won't need a doctor. They won't need to be careful about therapeutic activities. All will be good. You can throw the diet out the window. No more exercise unless you happen to enjoy it. Everything will be wonderful. How do I know that? He says, "Kamosha Amar Ki Ani Hashem Rofecha." He quotes another biblical verse. It's from Exodus, the 50th chapter or so. God says, "I am your healer." And he says, that's what the righteous people did. In the days of prophecy, in the era of prophecy, that's the way they handled it. God simply took care of things. So writes Nachmanides, sounding like it's ideal that you not go to a physician, that you just rely on God, be perfect, and God will take care of you. On the other hand, Nachmanides has a separate work called Torah HaAdam, a work of Jewish law, in which he says that there is a biblical commandment to heal. So which is it? Am I supposed to rely on the prophets, or am I supposed to go out and heal? So if you look in source number 5, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg wrote that you're dealing with two different situations, which is probably already evident in source number 4, but he states it explicitly. I'll say it outside the text, but you can look at it there. He says, Nachmanides is saying that yes, there is a possibility of an era when we are functioning in an optimal spiritual level, and in that case, we will be healed automatically. But that's not where we are right now. It's not who we are today. Today we need to turn to each other and get help and get healing. That's the reality of what it means to be a human being. And therefore, we are indeed obligated, those who are sick are obligated to go to the doctor, and the doctor is obligated to take care of them. Based on this, the patient is supposed to pursue healing, and the doctor is supposed to heal him, even over the objection of the patient. How far that goes, we'll have to see in a minute, but first I want to give illustrations. Take a look, please, at source number 6. Rabbi Yosef Karo, writing in the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, in the beginning of the 16th century, he's talking about Yom Kippur. You have somebody who's ill, who says, "I want to fast on Yom Kippur." And the doctor says, "You can't fast." So, cholesh etzarech leachol, a patient who needs to eat, im yesham rofei baki, if there is an expert physician present, afilu hu ove kochavim, whether he's Jewish or not Jewish, sheomer, im lo yachilu oso efshar sheyechvar olav acholi v'yistakein, the physician says, if he doesn't eat, his illness might become worse. Not where he knows for sure. He says the illness might become worse. The person might be endangered, machilin oso al piv. We feed him based on the word of the doctor, even the maybe of the doctor. Afilu machola omer eino tzarech shomim larofe. Even if the patient says, "I don't need it, I'm okay," we listen to the doctor. The patient is compelled to eat. That's the position in the Code of Jewish Law regarding feeding a patient on Yom Kippur. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, writing about 40 years ago, dealt with this in terms of patients who refuse life-saving treatment. And this is, if you take a look at source number 7, he's dealing with a case in which the refusal has already happened, and now the question is, so what do we do about it? And he wrote, "Im hu machmas she'eno ma'amin l'rofim elu, tzrichen limtza rofe she'ma'amin bo." If the reason why the patient is refusing treatment is because he doesn't trust these doctors, he says they don't know what they're talking about, so find him a doctor he's going to trust. V'leka rofei kazeh, if there is no doctor like that, v'efshar lefanov mitzad ha'machla l'chakos ad she'avin ishehu l'tovaso, and it's impossible because the patient is ill, you can't simply wait for him to come around and say, "Yes, I'll take the treatment." V'gam lo l'shalcho k'sherotzeh b'beis cholim u'b'rofim she'en b'yir acheres, and it's not possible to send him off to doctors in some other town where he will trust the medical advice. Mu'chrachin ha'rofim she'bekan lasos ba'al kor. Then the doctors who are present here have to act. They have to do it even against his will, but it gives you a caveat. Specifically, if all of the doctors in this hospital believe that that's what's necessary to heal him. You require medical consensus. You have to know that this is actually what's good for the patient based on current medical advice as received from the doctors who are present. If one doctor says, no, I don't think this is actually necessary, now you have a debate and the patient has a right to refuse. He continues. We're still in source number 7. It has to be done in a way that the patient is not going to become terrified. If the patient is going to become frightened, even if it's foolish, even if it's just because the patient doesn't understand, nonetheless, you can't do it. Because the patient who is terrified may well end up harming himself as a result of his terror. Obviously, it depends on the type of treatment and the type of situation. But Moshe Feinstein was a big believer in the psychological component to healing. And he argued that the patient who is absolutely refusing and is terrified is not going to get better. So therefore, you need to try to bring the patient along. And he concludes saying, "V'gam be'etzem nesinas refuah kazushi yesh basakana shenoeg in arufim litein kishemachalaso da'achol ha'mesukenes yoser mimidas sakana da'refuah atzma yesh lodun." He says, "I have another doubt. Sometimes you have a patient who is so dangerously ill that we will use treatments that are themselves quite dangerous. We wouldn't do it if not for the fact that you don't treat him, the patient's going to die for sure." So we're going to give the patient some level of chemo, some type of treatment that we know is going to damage his liver, because the choice is between damaging his liver or burying him next week. So we say, okay, so we'll give him the dangerous treatment. So Ramosha says, if you're dealing with a treatment like that, the treatment that's going to damage the liver and you know is going to really cause him harm, and it's just, well, we're desperate, we have nothing else to do, then it's not clear that we compel the patient to go along with it. So Rav Moshe has endorsed the idea that the patient cannot refuse treatment, but he has given us two reasons to hesitate. Number one, if it's not consensus, if not all doctors agree. And number two, if the treatment that you're going to give the patient is also harmful. So I want to come back to that. But right now, what we have seen is the idea that if there is a life-saving treatment, the patient, and it's an accepted treatment and so on, the patient has an obligation to follow it. Where does that leave the doctor? Now that we know that from a Jewish perspective, the patient has an obligation to pursue treatment that will heal. And by the way, this doesn't contradict what we said about Rabbi Hanina ben Tragio, because he was not in a case of healing. There was no healing option for him. It was a matter of die imminently or die in half an hour. There was no choice of saving his life. But where does that leave us now? If we're going to say, I am the doctor, and the patient is required to accept healing, and we've already said that I have an obligation to help him out, do I indeed face an obligation to see this through? And Rav Moshe already said yes, so I'm sort of cheating because I already quoted Rav Moshe Feinstein as saying yes. So let me ask the question a little bit differently. Why am I obligated to? What is the reason behind my obligation to see to it that this patient is going to be healed? We clear so far? I want to make sure that I didn't jump ahead of the sources. We've said that there is a general mitzvah of healing. We've said that even though you could argue God is the healer, nonetheless, we have a mitzvah of healing. Now we've said that the patient has an obligation to pursue healing. You're required to go to a doctor. What is it that obligates me, the doctor, to override the patient if the patient isn't holding up his end of the bargain? Yes? Sorry?
What do you mean by healing?
Good. So that's part of the question. What exactly does healing mean? You see, we already gave one answer, you shall not stand by the blood of another, right? We quoted it in source number 3. You shall not stand by the blood of your neighbor. So we have already said that there is a basic obligation to save lives. But what about something that isn't going to save a life? What about something that will simply extend survival for a little bit longer? Will that have the same obligation? What about something that's not life and death? Right? The patient is... There's a patient with some kind of chronic condition, and the doctor could do something to mitigate it, but he's not going to actually cure it at all. Is there any obligation now to provide that for the patient? So the answer is maybe. That's the answer. The answer is maybe. Take a look, please, at source number 9. I'm jumping over number 8. I don't need it so much. Yeah. Yes. So Zev says we have a distinction between prolonging life and improving quality of life, right? Those are the words I'm putting in your mouth. You said something else there that I want to make sure to pick up on. You said prolonging life so that he could say Shema for the next 6 months, right? And giving him a cream so that his rash won't itch and he can pray now without distraction. Why are we tying this to the mitzvah that he's performing? And if I have a possibility of healing somebody who isn't going to do that? We simply said, don't stand by the blood of your neighbor. We didn't say, don't stand by the blood of your neighbor who's going to say Shema. So I want to make sure that we're clear, that it's not, he doesn't have to sign a contract saying, I'm going to use what you gave me in order to, okay. So one approach is based on source number 9. Source number 9 deals with a touchy question. Children are prohibited biblically from wounding their parents. My children are going to watch this video, and they'll hear me say that. Children are biblically prohibited from wounding their parents. So the Talmud asks, what about if the child is a doctor and needs to do something to treat the parent, and it involves a wound? Simple, easy case, the classic treatment of letting blood. Leave aside the medical side of letting blood and whether it has any uses today, but the question is, can a child let blood for a parent? So, taking a look at source number 9, the Talmud asks the question, Ben Moshe Yakiz Damli Aviv, should a child let blood for his father? Rav Masna Omar Be'ahav Tolerei Achakamocha. Rav Masna says, absolutely, the Torah says, love your neighbor as yourself. In other words, what you are doing is a loving thing. What you are doing is taking care of somebody. You have a mitzvah of, go do this, and it will override any concern that I might have about the fact that you are also potentially causing, or not potentially, you are causing a wound. And so one view, and Nachmanides brings this among others, one view is, your obligation to help him is out of love, because of love your neighbor. If I take that approach, as opposed to the approach of don't stand by the blood of another, that should apply even to minimal mitigation of a person's circumstances. It isn't only about saving his life. It's doing anything to improve his circumstances. That will all come under love your neighbor. Love your neighbor doesn't mean save his life. Love your neighbor means improve his condition. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is a Talmudic principle that says, Zachin la'adam shalo b'fanav. I didn't bring it on the sheet. Zachin la'adam shalo b'fanav, which means you can acquire merit for somebody without their presence or without their knowledge. So, for example, you want to give a gift to somebody, but he's not here. You can give it to me, and I will acquire it on his behalf. It will be as though he acquired it. It is now his, for all intents and purposes. It has various ramifications within Jewish law. But the principle is that if something is a benefit for somebody else, you can acquire it without his awareness. You can acquire it without his even knowing what's going on. And on that basis, you could argue, I help the person who is sick, even without his awareness that I am helping him. So that's another potential argument. Yes? Ah, so that's one of the differences between these sources. Good. If I'm going to argue it's love your neighbor as yourself, and the person is screaming, I don't want you to do this, it's very hard to call that love. He said he doesn't want it. So the argument could be made that that's not included. However, if you take the argument of we acquire merit for somebody, even without his knowledge, perhaps... Hang on, I'm coming to it in 1 second. Let me make the argument first, and then we'll shoot it down. But the argument could be, I am helping him without his awareness of it, but it's a benefit for him. To which the answer comes, not necessarily. The argument is made by Tosfos, by the Rashba, writing in the 14th century, that the idea of zachin, that you acquire merit for somebody without his participation, only applies if it's a pure benefit. If it's going to cost him, then not so fast. So, for example, let's take the case of the gift. Today is December 30th. Right? I'm making that up. Today is December 30th. Someone says to me, I want to give a $20,000 car to so-and-so. Will you acquire it on his behalf? I say, sure. When I tell him about it, he's going to say, you know what you just did to me? I'm going to take a major tax hit for this $20,000 gift that I got on December 30th, and I don't need it. I have a car. I'm very happy with my car. The car is worth nothing to me. You think you were accepting a present for me, but in fact, you have harmed me because of the hit that I'm going to take from a tax perspective and the fact that this isn't worth $20,000 to me. So in such a case, we'll say you didn't really help it, and therefore you can't acquire it on his behalf. And so maybe this won't work in the medical case. So now, applying this to our situation, the woman says, I don't want to be healed. I don't want the chemo. You say, well, I'm giving it to you anyway because I love you. Love your neighbor as yourself. She says, that's not love. I don't want it. You say, well, zachan adam shelo b'fanav. It doesn't matter. We provide benefit for people. She says, it's not benefit. Every day I live, I'm going to be in greater pain. I don't want this. So then you'll say, well, maybe it's hashavas avida. We said in source number 3, there's the idea... Oh, we didn't get to it yet. I didn't finish the source. I wanted to wait with it until now. Go back to number 3, please. The Talmud asks a question. The Talmud asks about your obligation to intervene to help somebody else. Why do you bring this from, don't stand by the blood of your neighbor? I have a different source. The next source that I have, it's within this source number 3... where in the English it says, but is that law from this source? In the Hebrew it's, v'ha mehacha nafka. Does it really come from here? Mehasa nafka, I have another source. Avedas gufo minayin tama lomar v'ashevo so lo. The Torah talks about returning people's lost objects if you find them. And we understand that that includes restoring physical loss, restoring their person, not just their money. So he says, why do I need to say, don't stand by the blood of your brother? To which his answer is, imei hasam, if you only had the source about restoring lost objects and therefore lost health, I would have said, hani mili benafshei, avomitrach ve'umegar agurei emolo. I would have said, the obligation to restore lost objects only means physically, personally, I have to do that. I don't have to hire anybody else to help. Whereas if it's about, don't stand by the blood of your brother, that's a more serious obligation. For that, you even have to go spend money in order to do it. So they offer another possibility for why I am required to heal. Maybe I'm required to heal as part of restoring a person's lost health, just like I have to restore lost property. So will that apply here? In this case, the answer is not necessarily. Because let's imagine that there's a case of lost property. Let's say somebody has a tennis ball. And I see the tennis ball fall out of their car and roll down the street. And I say, I'm going to fulfill a mitzvah. That's great. I run over, I grab the tennis ball, I bring it back to the person. The person says, I didn't want the ball. I threw it out of the car, I don't want it. And he takes the ball and he chucks it down the street again. Do I have any mitzvah of running after it to return it to him? No. He doesn't want it. It's not his. He's not interested. So I have no mitzvah of restoring to him that which he does not want restored. So to take our woman again in vignette number one, she doesn't want her health restored. She doesn't want you to treat her. And therefore the argument will be, you have no role here of forcing her to accept the chemo. The only reason to compel that may be given is the issue of don't stand by the blood of your brother. That's the only one that really carries the weight to be able to override a person's refusal. However, as we said in Rav Moshe Klunstein in source number 7, that's not clear cut. It relies on there being a consensus of doctors that this is what's supposed to be done, and it requires that it be a clear-cut benefit, not a treatment that carries harm with it as well. Take a look, please, at source number 10. This is the classic source on it, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, writing in the 18th century. He says, "Nirali, it appears to me, davka kisharotze limnoa mihishtamesh perefua havadait, that we compel specifically if somebody refuses to use a definite cure, whatever definite means, there's no such thing as definite, but that we believe is going to work." In parentheses, he says, "Afastamit ayidei rofe mumcha kivadoes hashiva." Even if it's not definite, but it's what the experts recommend, that counts as a definite treatment. But if he refuses because, or in our case she, refuses because she doesn't believe that this is actually a tested treatment, even if it's the patient's own statement, "I don't believe you," and certainly if there is a doctor somewhere who will stand by her, and in this day and age there's no such thing as a treatment that some doctor somewhere will not challenge, so he says, "Ein kofin, we do not compel." And certainly if she's afraid that that treatment is going to harm her. Only if it's a known, obvious illness. The doctor has definite knowledge and a clear understanding. And he's using a known set treatment. That's where you can compel. It's a very steep demand that we're making here in order to really be able to compel treatment. And what that means is, based, you know, putting together what we've said for the past half hour, what we're really saying is, she may be obligated to accept healing. That could be. But I don't have the power to compel her. It could be that what she's doing is not completely right. It could be that she has an obligation to pursue life. Could be. But I don't have the ability as a doctor to force her to do so. If she refuses, I can't go any further with it. That would seem to be the case. And again, there are a lot of nuances here. You would need a real halachic authority who would be familiar with all the circumstances to rule on a particular case. Ellen. Right. So that's a very good question. And I can think of a couple of possible arguments to present on it. One argument would be that I'm assuming that this is an antibiotic-treated pneumonia. So there's a classic debate, not classic, I mean, it's actually fairly recent, as to whether antibiotics are considered to be sort of standard treatment or above and beyond. If you take the view that antibiotics are on the level of oxygen in food, that this is a basic, easy to administer, no pain type of thing, and that there's, yeah, then there really is an obligation to go ahead with that, I think. On the other hand, if that gets classified as heroic measure, in the eyes of halacha, not in the eyes of the legal system, then there's room to argue, she wants to die, let this be what takes her. So there definitely is room to make the argument. I'm not clear which side I would support. Yes.
In the exact same antibiotic,
Why is that?
Because if she's actively dying, then you can start
right.
That's to be a
micro
thing. And if she's able to swallow
her tail, it's just right. Right. I mean, one thing that would be a good idea for a class perhaps next year would be how we define heroic measures. How do we come to the conclusion of what is a heroic measure? I don't think we usually look at it in that framework of, you know, what, you know, where is the patient now and what is this going to do to the patient? I hear you, but I think it has to, I think I want to hold that one because I understand what you're saying, but I'm not sure I would go with that standard. Yes, Zeb. Right. It's a good question. We said here, what Zev is asking, you know, this room doesn't have great acoustics, but what Zev is asking is, we talk about a standard here of all doctors agreeing. And whether there's one doctor who disagrees, can she point to that doctor as justification for not accepting the treatment? You're in a regulatory system where something clears test after test and a whole board and panel and so on, and it becomes recommended for certain indications. Does that constitute all doctors agreeing? You could make the argument that since the doctors accept generally the regulatory process, therefore whatever the regulatory process produces is automatically accepted by them. The argument could be made. I want to look into that. That's going to be one of those things. For those who came in late, I do ask that everybody make sure to sign in so I can follow up about issues like this. I'd like to look into that a little bit further in terms of whether nowadays we would apply this system of all doctors agreeing, or whether there's room to state majority in some fashion. It's a good question, and really exacerbated by, you know, availability of every doctor everywhere all the time. The fact that I can email somebody who's on another continent and get an opinion, you know, expands the pool to ridiculous extremes. I could literally have 99,999 doctors on one side and one on the other, and I can have pulled each of them individually in order to get there. So it's true. So moving to vignette number two, we get to a case. Alex, 74, has been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And when I use that, again, as I said for vignette number one, my point is not to get bogged down in the specifics. When I use that, I mean something that, as a general rule, is fatal and relatively quickly, and is refusing to consider radiation, surgery, or chemotherapy. Alex's wife, Jill, suggests to the physician that she could hide oral doses of the chemotherapy drug, I may mispronounce this, fluorouracil, in his food. And as I had understood from my reading, this is something that can be administered as a monotherapy. It can be done alone. It's not going to push things off much longer. It may extend life somewhat. Should the physician pursue this course of deceiving a patient into taking medicine where it's not really going to heal? It's simply going to extend life, perhaps, for some small period of time by taking care of some of the symptoms, some of the development, for a period of time. So, in light of what we have already said for our first vignette, he may have the right to refuse the treatment. Right? In light of what we've said, the patient may well be able to say, this isn't curing me. It isn't improving my condition. It's prolonging things, so I refuse. So this may not be the best case. But in a case in which the medicine would heal him, what then? What would you say? Let's say it's not exactly this case. This may not be the best of cases. What would you say if the treatment actually would heal?
Well,
Sorry? Give the medicine. Yes. Right. In other words, the person is facing harm and you are intervening. You are not standing by the blood of your neighbor. You are indeed taking care of the person. And the fact that the person doesn't want you to take care of him. So, I believe this is an area in which, and I'm not clear 100% on it, but I believe secular medicine would probably disagree with what the halacha is going to say here. I'm guessing, based on knowledge of some areas of law, that secular medicine will say if a patient refuses the treatment, you cannot deceive the patient into taking the treatment. That's the general trend towards patient autonomy. Within the eyes of Jewish law, we absolutely do believe that you can deceive somebody in order to save his life. Where you're talking about saving somebody's life, you are able to and indeed required to, assuming it is, like we said before, a case of clear treatment, not where there's some debate, and a case in which it's not going to hurt him, it's only going to be a benefit. Adina, you had a question.
Yeah, I was going to say, but one, that one doctor disagrees.
Right.
Any of those other cases that you mentioned.
Right, and then you're not justified. Then I think you're not justified. It goes back to the discussion of compulsion. Ellen? So that's a very interesting next question, which we can't get into tonight. I gave a two-parter on this up at the Bayit, and at some point maybe we'll do it down here, and that's the issue of capacity to consent and capacity to refuse. At what point do we say that the patient has the ability to refuse? At what point do we say the patient doesn't actually have the ability to compute what's going on and come up with a rational decision? That you were going to that also?
Yeah, first of all, I think you were thinking about saving your life. What about just treating the psychiatry?
Right.
So again, secular law says you can't. I mean, there was a person in prison who said if he took his pills, he could get out. But as long as he takes his pills, he doesn't take pills, he's psychotic and homicidal, and he refused medication, so he stayed in the psychiatric prison.
There you go. It's a very interesting question. I mean, I think every society on some level has to agree that you can defy somebody to save his life. If a person is trying to jump off a bridge, we do try to get him off of that bridge. We have an idea of going against. I'm not clear on what the dividing line is. I suspect that our judicial systems aren't entirely clear either on where that dividing line is. Yes?
But on the other hand, you have two people, and even though treatment generally can save a person's life, two different people can react to different differences in the treatment. So it won't save his life. So it's not exactly, it may not be exactly
right, so that's another one of the complex issues that we're working with here, is we say, well, do you know that this is a good treatment or not? On the one hand, we said you have to know that this is a good treatment. Recognize that when we deal with probability in Jewish law, we are willing to accept a certain degree of certainty as certainty. If I know that 9,999 times out of 10,000, this is going to happen, I'm willing to accept that. We use that in all sorts of areas of halacha. So I think that it's possible to argue, even though I can never know with certainty this will work for this person, if statistics are overwhelming enough, I'm good with that. There was a question here first.
Well, it was kind of the same question. And what is the halakhic probability of certainty, if you will? In other words, part of the reason that, or some of the presumption in secular law with regard to patient consent, is that the patient has the right to refuse because there is a chance that the risks outweigh the benefit of the treatment.
Right.
What's the halakhic threshold where the risks outweigh the benefit of the treatment?
Right. I want to try to get some clarification on it and follow up with this one also by email, because I don't know offhand what we would do. I can quote cases. The classic case is Rabbi Moshe Sofer, who was asked regarding a phenomenon. People were concerned. This goes back to the beginning of the 19th century. People were concerned that there was a story that had gone around about someone who was buried, and then someone was walking through the cemetery and heard him banging away inside the casket. So this was at a time when the government wanted to enforce a three-day waiting period before burial. And Jewish authorities said, we bury same day. And someone said to him, well, you know, there is this story where somebody turned out to be alive. Don't you need to worry about that? And his answer was, something that happens once in thousands and thousands of times is not significant from a halachic perspective. I'm not going to now say that everybody has to wait 3 days for burial because you had this one bizarre case. That's not a scientific statement of threshold. He just uses the phrase one in thousands and thousands. We need to be able to do better than that. There are other cases I can cite that give similarly high thresholds, but none of them give really a number to work with. I want to see if I can get better clarity.
Medicine approaches 99%. Very little.
Okay.
Really?
99%?
It's very unusual.
Really? You wouldn't say that penicillin for a strep throat is 99%?
No.
Probably not. I don't treat strep throat, but that's some of the family members.
That's interesting. I'm a naive patient. The doctor says this is going to work, and I say, okay. Do a question in the corner.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's based on capacity, though. So they wouldn't have a situation in which someone had capacity, but someone was fully rational. He had just lost his job, his wife had left him, his children had done whatever to him, and so on and so on. He's fully rational. And he's miserable, and he says he'd like to end his life. Yes, it is. He understands the risk and benefit. He understands if he jumps, he's dead. I mean, he understands fully. I can come up with a case in which he can demonstrate fully that he is rationally comprehends everything around him. He says he has no hope and he wants nothing further. Enough for this case. Let's go to vignette 3 because we're already almost at an hour. And I wanted to make sure to get to this because it's an issue that has been in the headlines recently. Dr. Schwartz has a patient, Jim, 45, who suffers from hypertension. His family has a history of heart trouble. For years, Dr. Schwartz has been advising Jim to take on a regimen of cardiovascular exercise and to control his diet. But Jim has ignored his advice. May Dr. Schwartz refuse to see Jim as a patient? The case that I'm thinking of in the news was the vaccination discussion a couple of weeks ago about doctors who, it was in one of the local papers, doctors who are dropping families if they won't vaccinate their children. Now, I didn't use the vaccination case here because that has other issues, because it's not just the health of the person involved, it's the health of other people. So I didn't want to go into that. I wanted to give a case in which it's just my own health. Does a doctor, now that we know a doctor has an obligation to heal, right? Whether we talk about it as restoring lost objects, or whether we talk about it as love your neighbor, or whether we talk about it as don't stand by, the doctor has an obligation to heal. Does the doctor have the right to say, the patient isn't listening to me, therefore, I'm going to stop seeing this patient? What would you say? No? No? We've got no's. Any yeses? We got a yes. What's the reason to say yes that the doctor can refuse? Right, so one argument is there are other doctors in the universe. It's not as though he's not going to get medical care now. Another argument is maybe this is actually the greatest act of healing I can provide, is to stop just, you know, letting him go along saying everything is fine, because now I'm jolting him and I'm saying, you're not getting treated. So maybe that's actually, and that's the best way I can treat him, is to say to him, I'm not going to see you anymore.
Doctors don't see lots of patients. There's many reasons why a doctor cannot see a patient. Patient can't pay, the doctor doesn't have time. I mean, the doctor doesn't have to see this patient, the doctor has to see patients, has to help people. He doesn't have to help every single person in the world who needs his help. So he doesn't want to see this person.
Are you sure of that?
Yeah.
That the doctor is not obligated to? No, I'm serious. These are real questions.
You have to eat breakfast. You have to go home. If a doctor had to keep treating people all the time, then he would go home at the very last minute, of course, he would come back the next morning.
Right. We understand that doctors are human beings.
To do that.
No, doctors like firemen, like policemen, and so on, are human beings, and they require time off. But can they make their decision based on discretion like this?
Every day, people can go into the doctor, into a doctor's office, and the doctor says, I can't see it.
Right.
I mean, so why is this guy different?
The obligation the doctor has is to make sure that there is another physician, see this person, or cheaper person, to make sure that the care is done.
So there's a nuanced answer, right? It's, you can refuse him as long as you refer him. Okay.
You give him an alternate treatment and somebody that you look at. And the reason that you don't have to treat people that have a different philosophy than you is that it makes it very difficult for you to treat that person. So you can't have patients that come in and tell you how they want to be treated. If you know that that's not for their good, or not the way you think it's best to treat them.
Okay, I hear it.
And the law says that.
And the law says it, even better. Andrea. I'll give you the opportunity to say it fully. She couldn't hear you.
Oh. So what was it? The whole thing that I said? That physicians are not obliged to treat people that don't have the same philosophy for treatment as they do. You're not obliged to treat someone that doesn't want to take the treatment that you think is best for them. But you are obliged to get them another physician who can look at you if you can. So you cannot, you don't have to. There are certainly differences of opinion in patients. And I could bring forward the vaccine business. I know that affects other people as well. But I understand why the doctor said that. But the doctor has to make sure that patient or that family has treatment. And I also said that the law said that.
There we go.
Yes, we have heard that. Yes, you are in the future.
Not
as I said, the college does not set out. They give you guidance. outline why there's a failure of, I can't remember what the college's words are, but
I find this to be fascinating, but knowing that we gave people a certain time frame, I do want to make sure to hit one or two more things. The debate that we're hearing is a debate of whether I'm obligated to refer, whether I'm obligated to just see them for a period of time, whatever is considered to be reasonable, but they are the ones who are expected to find a new doctor themselves. From the Jewish law perspective, I am obligated to heal, but some of those obligations are suspended when the person says, I'm not interested in being healed. So, for example, the obligation we said before of restoring somebody's lost object does not apply in the event that he's throwing it out. In the event that he says, I am not interested in following your advice, means that I am not obligated to restore his lost health. So from that perspective, I have no obligation. What about the obligation of don't stand by your brother's blood? Does that continue? So there is a minority view that says, no. That says, no, I'm not obligated to take care of somebody under that law either, in the event that they aren't interested in listening to my medical advice. After all, in source number 3, the Talmud asked, what's the difference between restoring someone's lost object and don't stand by your brother's blood? And it didn't say, well, the difference is, what if he doesn't want to be healed? It didn't give that as a difference between the two. The law must be the same. The law must be that just like you have no further obligation to return his lost object if he's throwing it down the street, so too you have no obligation under do not stand by the blood of another. That's one argument. The Minchas Chinuch presents that argument. However, most authorities absolutely disagree. And they rule that one is obligated to take care of somebody else, even if he is refusing the treatment, even if he is trying to harm himself. So, for example, take a look at source number 18. I'm jumping a little bit in my sources in the interest of time. But take a look at number 18, please, with the following story. The story itself doesn't come because of our issue. It's brought in this work, Birkei Yosef, Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, to address a different question altogether. He's dealing with the question of amulets and the question of accepting amulets as a form of medicine. A great question in its own right. But take a look at what happens. Vayhi hayom leil Shabbos Kodesh. One Friday night, Ira Shanara Yisraelis Shazasash Sam Hamaves v'eschilu ladiv kemisa. There was a Jewish girl who drank poison. The assumption is intentionally in this story, and she started to show signs of dying. Ubo etzel aish halaz b'leil Shabbos. They came to a certain man who was known as a writer of amulets, and it's Friday night. V'kam v'kasav hakameya l'nara. He got out of bed and he wrote an amulet for the girl. V'tekef hikiyav Amda al Burya, and she vomited, and she was again healthy. Ubiyom haShabbos noda ba'ir kol asher na'asa. On Shabbos, word got around about what had happened. V'la'aza alav hamedina shachilol Shabbos b'shat nefesh, and word got around. People started gossiping and saying that man broke Shabbos. He wrote on Shabbos. V'kasav enasim biyada. He wrote it. He gave it to her. V'hu eishiv to be kuach nefesh docha Shabbos, and his answer was saving lives overrides Shabbos. Now their problem with him was not about the suicide case. Their problem with him was, are amulets considered to be valid medicine such that you could do that on Shabbos? So that's part of the question. I didn't want to go into the amulet point here. He takes it as a given, though, that assuming a treatment is recognized as valid, you do it even for this girl who was trying to kill herself. There is no greater case of someone who was rejecting medical advice than someone who willingly drinks poison. And yet, the statement was, you treat her and you violate Shabbos in order to do so. Now, there was no discussion in the legal work on this of whether she was rational at the time. We tend to assume that people who commit suicide in the eyes of Jewish law is assumed that they were not rational at the time. Nonetheless, the point that is brought out of this is that we do believe that one continues to treat including in violation of Shabbos, in order to take care of somebody who is refusing treatment. Under Lo Samor Al Dam Re'echa, not to stand by the blood of your brother, so that if someone is not listening to the doctor is still supposed to do his best to continue to treat, whether his best means finding him somebody else to listen to, or whether his best means talking at him every, however, you know, whatever the period of time is, and saying, look, you got to do this, you got to do this, you got to do this. Whatever it is, the doctor is indeed still supposed to continue to do his best to take care of the patient, whatever that best may turn out to be. To sum up what we've said, and I'll stick around for questions afterwards, but to sum up what we've said, number one, the patient does have an obligation to pursue healing. They despite the fact that God is called the healer, we are taught that in the absence of a prophetic age, when we are all on a great high spiritual level, we are supposed to go to doctors and get treatment, and doctors are supposed to try to heal us. So in vignette number one, is the patient allowed to refuse treatment? It would seem the patient is obligated to pursue treatment, and the doctor is obligated to try to help for any of the reasons we mentioned. Not standing by the blood of your neighbor, love your neighbor, acquiring benefit for somebody without their knowledge or involvement, restoring lost property, whatever reason you want to give, there is an obligation. However, it is possible to argue that a patient could refuse if some doctors, we want to try to get clarity on that, but if some doctors say this isn't a great approach, or it isn't going to work, or in the event that it comes with a cost, where it's going to cost the patient along with the benefit. We talked about deceiving a patient into taking medicine, and we said that in the event that it's clear that this is going to work, then indeed it would seem I would have an obligation even to fool the patient from the perspective of Jewish law. And what about refusing to take care of a patient? Even though some of my obligations to heal are suspended, my overriding principle of don't stand by the blood of another does still hold sway, and therefore I will be obligated to do my best to ensure that the patient is going to receive good treatment, whether from me or from somebody else. That's the quick digest. I do have the two outstanding questions that I wanted to see if I could get clarity on. One is, what constitutes all doctors agreeing? And the other is, what is the threshold percentage when we talk about saying this is known to work? So God willing, I will get back to you about those. I want to thank again the Lipsitz family for sponsoring the series. Jeff asked me to thank everybody for participating, so I'm thanking everybody on his behalf. I will, God willing, in a couple of days also send out an email soliciting topics and interest to see if there's interest in continuing this as a series next year. Thank you very much.